So tonight, Shear was put together against Richmond. Thank you. And the obviously, we started Slichus last night. So I just want to talk about, there's really going to be three parts to this Shear. Number one, I want to speak about what it means, the importance of hachana for a mitzvah. Obviously, now we're in the time of tshuva. We're in tshuva. We started Slichus last night, and we obviously need to put some serious thought and concern into this idea of tshuva and what it means to us, what Rosh Hashanah means to us, what all the mitzvahs hayom are going to mean to us. So obviously that is going to be number one of this year that we're going to discuss a little bit about hachana for a mitzvah. It's very difficult for an outsider to really prompt anyone or help anyone toward a hachana for their own personal mitzvah. It's difficult for me or for anybody to tell you how you should properly ready yourself for the mitzvah of tshuva or for the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah for whatever's going to be coming. So we're going to just speak in general about the importance. Everyone should do whatever they have to do. Once we speak about hachana, everyone should do accordingly. And then we'll speak about some minhag of Rosh Hashanah about dipping the apple in honey, and we'll get into a little halacha, a little machshava about that. So number one, when we talk about hachana for a mitzvah, so the Netziv, a very famous Netziv in two places. Number one, he has it in the Hemek She'ela. Number two, he has it also in Parshas of Eschanan, in the Hemek Davar. The Netziv writes, there are two different types of Hechsher Mitzvah that we find. Two different types of getting yourself ready for a mitzvah. Some types are, let's say, you get ready for Tkiyah Shofar, or for Igud HaLulav, for example. You put together the Lulav, put the Hadassim in, put the Aravos in, you tie it up, get everything ready before Sukkos. You have Tkiyah Shofar. You have to go buy a shofar. You have to do whatever you have to do in order to make sure that on Rosh Hashanah you're going to properly be able to be mekayem your mitzvah. That's one type of category of a introduction to a mitzvah or getting yourself ready for a mitzvah. Another category is the following. It says, for example, we have Ksiva Sefer Torah. Or we have Afiyas HaMatzos, right? The mitzvah is to eat the matzah, but obviously we have to bake them at some point. So Afiyas HaMatzos is another Hechsher mitzvah. Or making a sukkah. The mitzvah, obviously, ultimately is to sit in the sukkah, but there is something special about building the sukkah itself. Says the Netziv, these are two very different categories, and they are not to be confused with each other. He says, sometimes you need to do a hachana for a mitzvah, because that's the only way you're going to ever be able to do the mitzvah. Obviously, all mitzvahs that require an outside source need us to make some sort of hachana. However, says the Netziv, there are some mitzvahs that the Torah itself told us that there's something special about the hachana. For example, he says, This category of Hechsher Mitzvah are called Hechsher Mitzvah HaKasa BaTorah. For example, Chagas Sukkos Tasa Lacha. We have a mitzvah that we have to make the sukkah. It's not just to sit in the sukkah. We have to busy ourselves, like the Mishnah Berurah talks about, a person getting himself sweaty. Even if he's a big Talmid Chacham, he should go out and build his own sukkah. It's nothing to be embarrassed of. It's nothing that we should feel is beneath us. We should actually go ahead and build the sukkah on our own. Same thing with Saptam Amazuzos Pesecha. We have a mitzvah to put him a mezuzah. And it's not just that we should throw it off to someone else, it's something that we should do ourselves. If Shmartam Es HaMatzos, we should go and bake the matzos on our own. So it says in the Netziv, there are two different categories of ways to be mechen for a mitzvah, and sometimes the Netziv writes, B'Shem the Yerushalmi, sometimes when we have that special category that the Torah itself told us to be involved in the preparatory stages, in those type of examples, the Netziv writes, B'Shem the Yerushalmi, a person even has to recite a bracha while he's doing that activity. So that's just with regard to the two categories of leading up to a mitzvah. Then, I just want to go through a few examples where we find the importance of hachana for a mitzvah. So number one, the Chiddush Arim points out something very fascinating. He says that Nisach HaMayim on Sukkos is one of the highlights of the Yontav of Sukkos, like we see in the last parak in the Gemara in Sukkah. So Gemara tells us that, what was this special Nisach HaMayim called? Nisach HaMayim, obviously, but they used to make a very special celebration after the Nisach HaMayim. What was that called? The Simchas Beis HaShoeva. So the Chiddush HaRim points out, what was the mitzvah itself? The Nisach HaMayim, right? Pouring of the water on the Mizbeah. So why do we call it Simchas Beis HaShoeva? Shoeva means the drawing of the water. So the Chiddush HaRim points out that it's very strange that we call the Simcha of Simchas Beis HaShoeva by the name of the drawing, which is just the build-up, the lead-up to the mitzvah, which is actually the Nisach HaMayim. Says the Chiddush HaRim, that it would seem from here that obviously we're more excited about the drawing of the water itself, which is only the lead-up, it's the build-up to the mitzvah. That obviously causes more of an excitement to us than the mitzvah itself, the Nisach HaMayim. And we'll get to this in a minute, exactly why this is true. The Ger Rebbe also writes something interesting, that when it comes to Shiluach HaKan, so we have a mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, as many of us might know, that there is a mother bird sitting on top of a nest, and we're supposed to shoo away the mother bird and take the eggs for ourselves. So when we come to that mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, the Gemara tells us in the last parak in Chulin, mitzvahs in parak Shiluach HaKan, not the last parak, one of the last parakim. So the Gemara tells us that that is called a mitzvah kala, a light mitzvah. Why is Shiluach HaKan called a light mitzvah? Plenty of mitzvahs I could have said are very easy. So Shiluach HaKan happens not to be so easy. You have to figure out exactly where you're going to be chayiv and where you're going to be pater. Not all the circumstances call for Shiluach HaKan. You have to go up on a ladder and shoot away with a broom. It doesn't always work so quickly. Sometimes the eggs fall down. It's not such an easy thing to do. So why does the Gemara tell us it's called a mitzvah kala? It says the Chiddushi Arim that the reason why it's a mitzvah kala is because this is a mitzvah that has no preparation that can ever be built into the mitzvah itself. Why? Because the Gemara tells us that Shiluach HaKan, the only time you're able to do the mitzvah is ki kari lecha, when you chance upon a mother on top of a nest, that is the only time we have a mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan. A person, prat lemezumen, the Gemara says, a person is not able to do the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan if he set up that situation. For example, if he builds a nest and he puts eggs in it, and then he puts a mother bird on top to sit on top of the eggs, that would not require a person to do Shiluach HaKan. Therefore, it says the Chiddushi Arim, that would not be called a very special category of mitzvah. That's a mitzvah kala. That's easy. That's nothing. It's baby stuff. If a person could walk into a mitzvah and he has no way to prepare himself for that mitzvah, it's just a ki kari lecha, just chances upon him, and that's when he's going to walk into doing the mitzvah. So the Chiddush Arim writes, that's something that has obviously a lower level, shall we say, of a status of a mitzvah than other mitzvahs might have. We find by Halakas HaMenorah. It's interesting, if you look in the Rambam, there's a little variation here, but the simple understanding of Halakas HaMenorah is the following. All Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash has to be done, obviously, by a Kohen. However, Shechita can be done even by a non-Kohen. The Gemara tells us because Shechita is not really considered an Avodah, whatever it is. So when it comes to Halakas HaMenorah, so lighting the menorah is one of the Avodahs, so therefore it has to be done by a Kohen. Every morning and every night we light the menorah. That has to be done strictly by a Kohen. We do find, though, that the Hadlakas HaMenorah, there is a difference. There are two parts to the Hadlakah. One is the lighting of the menorah itself, and one is the cleaning out of the cups of the menorah from the oil from the night before. So here is where it gets very interesting. When it comes to the lighting of the menorah, that can be done either by a Kohen or by a non-Kohen. When it comes to cleaning out the cups from the menorah, that has to be done only by a Kohen. Strange thing. What is the Ikar HaMitzvah by Hadlakas HaMenorah? If I would ask anyone on the street, they would tell me it's the lighting. It's not the cleaning out of the wicks. It's not the cleaning out of the oil from last night. So it's an interesting thing over here that we find also that the build-up, the cleaning up of the mitzvah, which is just the lead-up to the lighting itself, has a certain special status where we say that it requires a Kohen, and a Zar would not be able to do that, even though the lighting itself, the mitzvah itself, which is the lighting, and that's going to last all night long and all day, that can be done even through a non-Kohen. Just when it comes to Parshas Emor, that's the Parshas HaMaladim as we know it. So the Psukim tell us as follows, U'lakachtam lachem b'yom harishon, p'yetzadar, kapas tamarim. So we have a mitzvah on the first day of Sukkot, we're supposed to take Dalad Minim. So Rashi already points out, the Medrash Tanchuma has the kasha. What do you mean? What day of the month is Sukkot? What day of the month? 15th. So why do we say U'lakachtam lachem b'yom harishon? It's not the 15th day. It's the 15th day of the month. It's not the first day of the month. So what does the Gemara mean? What does the Pasuk mean over here when it says, Elokachtam lachem b'yom harishon? It says the Medrash, and Rashi quotes this on Chumash, that it's Rishon l'chesh ben avonus. Obviously, it's not to be taken literally. Obviously, we're not supposed to take the Dalad Minim on the first day of the month. That's a mistake. We're supposed to take it on the 15th. So why does it say b'yom harishon? So the Gemara says, because it's Rishon l'chesh ben avonus. What does that mean? So the Medrash Tanchuma tells us the following. A person in between Yom Kippur and Sukkot is so busy with his Dalad Minim, and he's checking under a microscope, and he's figuring out, he's going to this store, and to that store, to the other one, trying to buy his Dalad Minim. Then finally he gets the Dalad Minim, now he has to go build his Sukkah. So that's going to take him a whole long time, till he gets the lights up, till he gets the schach up, till he figures out how to build everything, all the nails and the hammers, and his children want to put up all the decorations and everything. So he's going to be so busy leading up to Sukkot, and then his wife is going to be busy making all the food. So everything's going to be too much of a tumult, he's not going to have a chance to even think about doing an aveir. That's what Rashi tells us on Chumash, b'shem the Medrash Tanchuma. Rashi's not as graphic, but that's pretty much what he says. So we're not going to have any time to think about doing an aveir. However, comes the first night of Sukkot, kachtam lachem b'yom harishon, the first time a person has a chance to actually sit down in a sukkah and enjoy the sukkah, so then we're concerned, it's rishon l'chesh ben avonos. This is the first opportunity I'm going to have to do an aver. Fracta Tazan Shulchan Aruch Arachayim. I don't understand something here. Tavkuf Pei Aleph, look it up. The Taz has the following question. You're telling me that when I'm preparing for the mitzvah, I'm getting my dalim minim, I'm checking them under the microscope, I'm bringing it to the rabbi, I'm going and putting on my sukkah, I'm doing everything I have to do, I'm going to be so busy preparing for sukkahs that I'm not going to have a chance to think about doing an aver. But now, comes sukkahs itself, comes the time when I'm supposed to be sitting in the sukkah, when I'm supposed to be enjoying the mitzvah, when I'm supposed to be involving myself in ruchnias, now I'm going to have a chance to sit and do an aver? What does that mean? I'm not going to have a mindset, I would never think of doing an aveira while I'm preparing myself for the mitzvah. But when it comes to the mitzvah itself, I have plenty of time. I would have thought the opposite would be true. When a person's only in the preparatory stages, he doesn't take it so seriously. But when it comes to the mitzvah itself, I would have assumed that his mind is so preoccupied with the kedusha, with doing the mitzvah, with the ruchnias, with sitting in the sukkah, with shaking lulav, that then he has no time. So the Taz has this question, and he thinks it's a very strange thing that we find. So, says the Sfas Emes in Parshas Hazinu, in answering this question, the Sfas Emes writes the following. Kadol Milas HaHachana LeMitzvah Me'etzem HaMitzvah Gufa. Says the Sfas Emes, it's not crazy to believe that sometimes, and he's going to give two reasons why, we'll get to that in a minute, but he says it's not crazy for us to imagine that the lead up to the mitzvah, that the amount of effort and energy that a person puts into a mitzvah before it actually happens is greater than the outcome of the mitzvah itself. What does that mean? Says the Sfas Emes. It's not crazy for us to assume such an assumption. And he explains the following. He gives two reasons why we should assume that possibly a hechsher mitzvah, possibly the lead up, the hachana for the mitzvah itself, might be greater to us than the mitzvah when we do it on its own. Why is that? So he says the following. Reason number one, says the Sfas Emes, because, you know, the way I think about this, just as a hakdama, the way I think about this is the following. My sister just got married, and many of us have experienced siblings getting married. I assume? No? Some of us? None of us? Okay. I experienced 8 siblings getting married. So, what happens? So we're trying to plan a wedding, and all of a sudden, both sides have to come together, start calling halls, and then they have to book a band, and figure out, put down a deposit, and then you have to go to the stationery store, whatever, to the printer and get invitations, and they're fighting. This side wants invitations like this, and this one wants like that. We want on this day, we want on Sunday afternoon, Sunday morning, Sunday night. Everyone then, what are we going to serve? We're going to get the best caterer, but we want meat, we want chicken, we want vegetables, we want salad, we want soup. It is in the summer, it's not in the summer. We want hot stuff, cold stuff, everyone. So everyone's fighting, and it's months and months of preparing, and finally you send out the invitations, then the response cards don't come back, then you have to start calling everybody. How many months does it take to plan a wedding, correct? Everyone knows that's true. It takes forever and ever. And then you get to the wedding, and what happens? It's over in like 5 hours. That's the whole thing. Before you know it, the whole thing is done. Correct? I mean, to me, this is mamish what the Sfas Emes says. Reason number one, the Sfas Emes writes, why hachana to a mitzvah sometimes is more meaningful to us than the mitzvah itself, is the same example that we give by the wedding. We prepare ourselves. A person can prepare physically, he can prepare spiritually, mentally, he can work on himself to a certain point, to make sure that he's ready to do this specific mitzvah. But when the mitzvah comes itself, it might just be 1 second. When it comes to actually shaking lulav, that's going to be over in a flash. So you're right. Obviously, if you don't end up doing the mitzvah itself, you have nothing, right? That's obvious. That's nothing to negotiate. But he says that the amount of time that a person works on himself, the amount of time that a person puts in to the mitzvah before it actually happens, there's a very good reason that it might be more meaningful than the mitzvah itself, because the mitzvah is gone in such a flash, and the hesaros that a person might have had from the preparation that he did for the mitzvah might be even greater. That's reason number one that the Sfas Emes writes. Reason number two, he says, why we take hachana for a mitzvah very seriously, is because he writes the following idea. We have no idea what exactly Hashem had in mind when he gave us this specific mitzvah. Let's say it comes to Dal and Minim, you know? I dam for the Amidim while you on Yom Naram. I remember before the first year that I dam for the Amidim, I asked my father, what kavanas am I supposed to have in mind? You know, I don't know. I was like a young guy. I'm still pretty young. And I had no idea what am I supposed to be thinking when I'm davening for the Amidim. So he said, you know, there's a Magen Avraham, I think he said in Hilchos Pesach, where someone asked one of the Rishonim, what are you supposed to have in mind when you're eating the matzahs? Right? You know, the Chassidim always have things in mind. So someone asked one of the Rishonim, what are you supposed to have in mind? So the Rishon answered back, you should have in mind that you're being mekayem the mitzvah of achilas matzah. So my father said to me, you should have in mind that you're being shliach tzibur for the tzibur and you're trying to daven with kavanah. That's it. No great kavanas here. So the Sfasemis writes that it's very difficult for us to know exactly what the Ribbono Shel Olam had in mind. Which kavanas I'm supposed to have? It's impossible for us to even be mechavim when we're davening Shemona Esrei to say all the words with the proper kavana. So how do you think when I'm picking up a lulav and an esrog and I have no idea what I'm supposed to be thinking about? So it's very difficult for us to actually put ourselves in the situation that the Ribbono Shel Olam prescribed for that mitzvah to be fulfilled in. So therefore, says the Sfasemis, since it's very difficult for us to get to the Tachlis HaGemura, to get to that pinnacle level which the Torah prescribed us to keep the mitzvahs on, therefore he says that's why the preparatory stages are very worthwhile, because we never know if we're actually being mekayim the mitzvah in its most pristine stage. We don't know if that's the way we're actually going to end up being mekayim it, but we do know that if we put personal effort into the hakhanas, if we work on ourselves personally, if mentally, if we work on ourselves to make sure that we become better people before we're mekayim a mitzvah, that the Ribbono Shel Olam can never take away from us. That's something that we're always going to have. That's something that's going to be everlasting and very special to us. So that's why it's something that's considered very special. And one last example that I want to bring out about this is the following. The Psukim tell us by the Dor HaMidbar that they were given a commandment that they were supposed to build a Mishkan. So says the Pasuk, at the end of finally they finished building the Mishkan, collected all the money, now they're ready to actually serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Beis HaMikdash. They're actually ready to bask in the glory of the Shechina. So the Pasuk tells us as follows, Vayika biyom kechalos Moshe lehakim es HaMishkan. So it was the day that Moshe Rabbeinu finally finished to put up the Mishkan, and now they're ready to serve. Says the Medrash over there, very strange Medrash, Vayihi. What does the word Vayihi mean? Vayihi biyom kechalos Moshe. What is that word Vayihi? Says the Medrash as follows, Vayihaya. Terrible thing. Terrible thing that Moshe Rabbeinu finished building the Mishkan. What's the terrible thing? So says the Medrash as follows. Mashallah Adam, the Medrash tells us there is a person who was always getting in fights with his wife. He could never get along. Every night he would come home from work and his wife would yell at him, scream at him, put this away, put that away. He was always a shlamazel. He was doing everything wrong. She was a shlamazel. In his eyes, everything was wrong. Everything was going backwards, upside down. So they kept getting in fights. So the husband's trying to figure out, why is it that we keep fighting? Everyone else can get along just fine. And it just so happens to be with this woman, I can't get along. What's happening here? So he makes a cheshbon and he realizes the reason why is because I'm at work all day. I have no time to sit and think about, to pick on her, to think about what I'm doing wrong, what she's doing wrong. I have no time for this. She sits home all day. I support her. So she has time to sit and think about everything I said, to sit and watch everything I do. So therefore, when I get home, she berates me with everything that she thought about all day long that I did wrong. So therefore, he says, what am I going to do? I'm going to give her the hardest, most difficult work to be involved with. And then she won't even have time. She'll come home at night. She'll be so exhausted. She won't have time to think about all the things I did wrong. So that's going to be the eitzah. So he comes home the next day and he says, you know what? I found you a job. It's going to be a 9-to-7 job. It's going to be so difficult, but I'm telling you, it's going to be the great salary, greatest salary in the world. We can retire on this, but work for the next 25 years. And everything's going to be great. Fine. And a month goes by. They haven't gotten in one fight. She comes home at night. She's just ready to drop dead. She's so tired. He's ready to drop dead. He's so tired. Everything's wonderful. It's not my mashal. This is the Medrash. So the Medrash says, that's the same thing that the Ribbono Shel Olam said over here. Vayihi biyom kalos Moshe. So what's happening in the Dor HaMidbar? Klal Yisrael is complaining to Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't have water. We don't have food. We don't have this. We don't have that. We don't have clothing. We can't go to the bathroom. Everything's wrong. Everything's terrible. They don't like the whole situation. What does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He tells the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm having a problem. What do I do with these people? They don't stop fighting with me. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you know what? We're going to give them a job. It's going to keep them busy from 9 to 7. They're not going to even know what hit them. By the time they get home at night, they're not even going to know how to find Moshe Rabbeinu because they're going to be so tired. Let's busy them with the building of the Mishkan. Interesting Medrash. So the Medrash tells us, that's what they did. The Ribbono Shel Olam gives a mitzvah. Klal Yisrael should involve themselves in Binyan HaMishkan. So, here they are, everyone's bringing the wood, everyone's bringing the bricks, and this one's sewing, and this one's knitting, and everyone's doing whatever they're supposed to do, that one's painting. Finally, Vayihi biyom kalos Moshe, oy vey, vayihaya. I wish we were still in the days when Klal Yisrael was busy with the building of the Mishkan, because then they wouldn't have any time to sit and complain. But now that they're done, they're going to have all the time in the world, they're going to give Moshe Rabbeinu a problem again. So that's the words of the Medrash. Ask the Shem Yishmol, I don't understand. When it comes to the Binyan HaMishkan, that wasn't the mitzvah itself, the mitzvah was the end result was to have a Beis HaMikdash. So what do you mean? Klal Yisrael is going to be so busy when they're building the Mishkan that they're not going to have a chance to complain. But when the Mishkan is built, what's going to change? I would have thought when the Mishkan is built, and now you have avoda all day long, now you could go watch everything that's going on in the Beis HaMikdash, now that there's so much happening there, Everyone's going to be basking in the glory of the Shekhinah, so they're going to have no havamina of ever doing an aver. No one's going to have a chance to even think about doing anything wrong. Says Hashem Yishmol, no. It doesn't always work that way, because every individual person that puts something into a mitzvah, every individual person that was working on the Binyan HaMishkan, that was working on the Hachana for the mitzvah, was working on himself mentally, was trying to better himself, was trying to improve himself, and therefore, the Shem Yishmol writes, they had no chance to sit and think about doing an Aver. They were working so tirelessly on themselves as they were building the Mishkan, and therefore, that saved them from doing Chet. However, once the Etzem HaMitzvah came along, sometimes it's not so easy for a person to get himself into the right mindset. Sometimes it's not so easy to get ourselves to do the exact thing that the Torah prescribed for us. So therefore, they did have a chance to do Averis and to complain once the Mishkan was already built. So all this being put in perspective, obviously as we started, it's not so easy for an outsider to tell anybody how he should prepare himself physically or spiritually, mentally, for the Mitzvah HaTshuva or for the season of the year that we're in. That is obviously left up to each individual person on his own, what he needs to fix. But we're just pointing out that it is something that takes up a lot of literature in the Machshava Svarim. It's something that we do take seriously, that we try as much as we can to ready ourselves for a mitzvah before the time of the actual mitzvah comes along. So the only way that I can ready all of us, possibly, for the mitzvahs of Rosh Hashanah is to talk about some of the halacha lemaisa. That's one way that we can ready ourselves that's not based on an individual level. So we're going to talk about the following issue. And this really is broken down into two components. We're going to talk about the minhag that the Ramah talks in Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, that a person is supposed to dip his challah or dip his apple into honey. We all know this from kindergarten. Dip an apple in the honey. It's a wonderful thing we're supposed to do on Rosh Hashanah. But what's the deeper meaning behind this minhag? And what exactly is the heter to eat honey at all? Now you're going to ask me, what's the heter to eat honey? What's the problem with eating honey? So let's see. The sugya is as follows. Very interesting halacha sugya. That is very nogea halacha lemaisa, as we'll show from many different examples throughout halacha and yoredeya. The Gemara tells us in a couple of places that there's a din of yotze min ha'aser is us. We have an iser to eat not only a non-kosher bird, not only a non-kosher animal, we're also not allowed to eat something that is extracted from a non-kosher animal. For example, you have a donkey, and the donkey, not a donkey, what other non-kosher animal produces? What? A pig. A pig produces milk, correct? So you're going to have a pig. Obviously, we know you're not allowed to eat the pig, but what about drinking the milk of a pig? I would have said maybe that's something else. So the Gemara tells us that we learn from a pasuk that says by Bas Hayana that the same way the bird itself is not kosher, so too the Bas Hayana, the child that comes from the bird, the chick that's born from the bird, is also forbidden for us to eat. So that is with that. So Rashi writes in Chulin Daf Samach Dalet, as well as the Rambam, that we will not get malchus if we drank the milk from a pig. Why? You get malchus if you eat the pig itself. But if you eat something that comes from the pig, or you eat something that comes from a non-kosher animal, that is not considered to be like the pig itself. That's the way the Rambam learns. However, Tosis and Chulin disagrees and says, no, the same way the pig is usher, the same way I'm not allowed to chop off a slice of meat from the pig, so too I'm not allowed to drink the milk from the pig as well. That would constitute an iser of achilas chazir. So Rav Shach writes in explaining the Rambam Shita over here why we wouldn't get Malchus on eating something that's extracted from a pig. So Rav Shach writes the following. He says that there's one Isser to eat a pig, and then there's an Isser Chadash, there's a new thing of Yotze Min HaAser. There's a separate Isser that the Torah tells us that we're not allowed to eat something that's extracted from a pig. That is only an Isser Aseh. That's the way Rav Shach explains the Rambam Shita. And therefore he says that's why the Rambam tells us we will not get Malchus if we ate something that's extracted from a non-kosher animal. So that's with regard to the machlokas, the Rambam and Rashi and Tosfos. So that is with regard to that. So let's go through a couple of halachas and show where this comes up. Number one, there is a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, when it comes to eating human flesh. Not sure who would ever do that, but just we'll talk theoretically for a minute. The Rambam writes in Machalas Asuros that if a person eats human flesh, he does not get malchus. Why? So he says because it's only an Isser Aseh. And as we all know, the Gemara tells us the only time one would get Malchus is if he violates an Isser in the Torah that is Dumi Delav Dechasima, something that is a Lav in the Torah, not something that is an Isser Aseh. So therefore the Rambam writes that if you eat human flesh, you would not get Malchus. The Ramban in Ksuvas Daf Samach Amud Beis disagrees, and the Ramban says, no, there's no Isser at all. If a person feels that he enjoys, for some reason, if he enjoys eating human flesh and he happens to find some around, So he's allowed to eat the human flesh. There is no Isser Daraisa involved at all in eating human flesh. Ask the Ramban on the Rambam. How can you tell me that there is an Isser in eating human flesh? Don't we all know that a child nurses from its mother, right? The only sustenance that a child has is to drink the mother's milk. So don't we know there's an Isser Yotzim and an Usser? Same way, you're not allowed to eat a pig, so you're not allowed to drink the milk from a pig. So if the Rambam's going to tell me that there's an Isser Daraisa to eat human flesh, ask the Ramban, how am I allowed to drink? Not me. How is... The Gemara tells us in Ksuvos Daf Samach, there's some background here, that an adult also would be allowed to drink woman's a milk that a woman produces, but Mishum Aras Ayin, he shouldn't. So that's with regard to that. But how is anyone allowed to drink milk from a human being? Isn't that a Yotzim and a Usser? That's the question that the Ramban raises on the Rambam. And the Magen Mishnah discusses this question of the Ramban, and he comes out that the Rambam has some Chiddush to Keshita, that the only time one would say that there's an Isser Yotzim and a Usser is when it's coming out of an Isser Lav. But there's no Din Yotzim and a Usser when it's just coming from an Isser Aseh. So over here, since the Rambam believes that eating human flesh is only going to constitute an Isser Aseh, the Rambam has a Mechudish de Keshita that this would not constitute any Isser of Yotzim and Aser, and that's why the milk from a woman would be permissible. How about when it comes to milk in general? How is that permissible? The Gemara says in Mechoras Davav, don't we know that there's an Isser Behema Becheskas Isser Amedes? Behema Bechaya, while an animal is alive, so the animal is Becheskas Isser. Rashi and Tosis have Machlokes, what exactly does that mean? What's the Isser if I see a live animal in the street? What Isser is that? Anyone know? I would assume Evron Achai. So that's what Rashi writes. The whole time that I have an animal that's not shechted, so there's an Isser Evron Achai, to take anything from that animal, is what the Torah tells us Evron Achai, which we know is also for a Jew and for a non-Jew. Tosis and Beit Zadav Papay disagrees and writes that the Isser on a live animal, when I see it walking down the street, he makes up a new Isser of Enes Vucha. Since I have a mitzvah that I have to shecht every animal, so now there's an Isser Enes Vucha if I take an animal and eat something from it without a proper shechita. Be it as it may, so the Gemara Mechoras Daf Vav asks the question, if we know that every live animal has some sort of Isser, either Enes Vucha or Evron Achai, whatever the Isser might be, so how can you tell me that I'm allowed to drink milk from an animal, even from a cow, a kosher animal? Why isn't that Yotzim and Aser? Right? The milk is being extracted from an animal that has some sort of Isser on top of it. So how can you tell me that I'm allowed to drink milk? Says the Gemara, because we have a pasuk that says, Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash. One of the shvachim that we have for Eretz Yisrael is the fact that it's Zavas Chalav Udvash. So you're going to tell me that one of the great things about going to Eretz Yisrael is that you're going to be able to drink milk. The problem is, milk is Aser. So what's so great about drinking milk, then, if we're not allowed to drink it? So therefore, says the Gemara, since the pasuk tells me, Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, that Chalav is considered a staple of society, Chalav is considered a real special thing that we're going to have tons of it in Eretz Yisrael, so therefore the Gemara tells us it must be that milk is permissible. We have Gzeiras HaKasuv, that although, if you follow the dots, really we should say that milk should be Aser from a cow. We shouldn't be allowed to drink it because a cow really, while it's alive, is not permissible. So we should assume that anything that comes out of it should also be Aser. Yet the Gemara tells us, since the Pasuk says, Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, we assume that one would be allowed to drink milk. When it comes to eggs, the Shach and Yeridea also discusses an issue when it comes to the eggs. Simon Pezayin, which is the beginning of Hilchas Basar V'Chalav, so the Shach raises the following issue. How am I allowed to eat eggs? Don't we know that eggs come from a chicken? A hen? Chicken? Same? Whatever? So eggs come from a chicken, and we know that a chicken is not allowed to be eaten until it has a proper shechita. So how am I allowed to ever eat an egg? Good question, no? It's a problem. So what do you do about this? My problem is, how could it be that the Shach was the first one to raise this issue? What did they do until he came around? So the Shach writes the following, that since we have a mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, now what does it say by the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan? V'asabanam tikach lach. The Ikra Din is that you're supposed to take the chicks, you're supposed to take those eggs that you take away from the nest, and you're supposed to eat them. Says the Shach, if you're going to tell me that eggs are usher, you're never allowed to eat eggs, so what do you mean? V'asabanam tikach lach. I have a Mefurash Pasuk in Chumash that tells me, a Shvera Pasuk. How can the Pasuk tell me you're allowed to eat eggs if we know that eggs are Yotzim and Aser? Eggs come from a chicken, and a chicken till the shechet is not permissible to eat. So how could it be I'm allowed to eat them? So therefore he says it must be that eggs are mutter. We have Gzeiras HaKasuv that eggs are permissible. That's what the Shach says. It says of some sofer, maybe according to the Shach, a person might argue and say that the mitzvah of Es HaBanam Tikach Lach is only by Jews. So maybe a non-Jew is not allowed to eat eggs. Because a non-Jew doesn't have this mitzvah of as Abanam Tikach Lach, but a non-Jew has an Isra of Eber Menachai. How do you like that? So maybe a non-Jew is not allowed to eat eggs. That's Chacham Sefer's Kasha. Says Chacham Sefer, no. We all know that there's a principle in Chulin Daf Lamed Gimel that Miyika Midi. Is there anything that a Jew is allowed to do, and you're going to tell me a non-Jew is not allowed to do it? How could it be? How can you tell me that a non-Jew has more... One second. How can you tell me that a non-Jew has more restrictions than a Jew has? So therefore, says Chacham Sefer, once we're matir, a Jewish person to eat an egg, because it says, Vashiluach HaKan, that, Vasarbanam Tikach Lach, so based on this principle in Chulin Daf Lamed Gimel, we're also going to allow a non-Jew to eat the eggs as well. Although he has an Isra Eber Menachai, and he has no mitzvah of Shiloh HaKan, we're still going to tell him that he's allowed to eat the eggs. Yeah?
Isn't it more like almost a thing that when it comes to having married a sister or something like that, and more
like Mi Kamidi.
But Gemara doesn't say that. Gemara says that we should ask for the Rabbana, I think, than Gemara.
Right.
Gemara doesn't say it's asking for the Reisa.
Right. So it's a big shaila. The Rashba and the other Rishonim have a discussion. How exactly do we fit this principle into all the Gemaras that we find? Is it true that there's never a time when a guy is more muzer than a Jew? What do you mean? Let's say a Nachri. One easy example. It's not so pasha that there's a good example, but it's a simple example to understand. We know that a non-Jew is not allowed to even steal pachas mishava pruta. Right? We know that a non-Jew gets killed for stealing. We know that a Jew does not. A Jew has a mitzvah v'heshuva z'gzela. So what do you mean? Mi'ika midi, is there such a thing that a non-Jew has more restrictions than a Jew? You're going to tell me if a non-Jew steals, he gets killed. If a Jew steals, he doesn't, right? He just gives it back. So what's going on here? How can you tell me that a non-Jew has more restrictions than a Jew? So it's not so clear exactly how to draw the line in terms of this Gemara and Chulin Daf Lamed Gimel, but for now, that's what the Chacham Sefer writes. Based on this, the Chacham Sefer takes it one step further, and he says, this would only allow a non-Jew to eat eggs from a kosher bird, because a kosher bird is part of the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein. However, what would be the case if you have a non-kosher bird, and the non-kosher bird lays eggs? So what would you say in such a case? Says the Chacham Sefer, well, based on this whole understanding, there would be no heter for a non-Jew to eat an egg that is not from a kosher bird. Why? Because really an egg is something that's yotzei min ha'aser. An egg comes out of an animal that is a eber min ha'chai. So we should really say all eggs are aser. But we have a pasuk by Shiluach HaKan which tells us that we're allowed to eat the eggs. So that tells me that the eggs of a kosher bird are allowed to be eaten. But says the Chacham Sefer, when it comes to a non-kosher animal, a non-kosher bird that lays eggs, so there's no heter for a Jew to eat it because the whole bird is not kosher, so too there's no heter for a non-Jew to eat it. Therefore, says the Chacham Sefer, not only is a non-Jew forbidden from eating these non-kosher eggs, a Jew is not allowed to sell it to him because that would constitute a violation of lifnei iver l'asita mikshah. It's a pella that the Chacham Sefer writes, big chiddush, and it's something to stay away from. If we happen to own a store and we're selling non-kosher eggs to the population that might not eat kosher, something to think about, to take into account. Others say that based on the Rambam we said before, that the violation of Yotzei Min HaAser is an Isser Chadash. It's not that it's something that the same way a pig is Aser, so to the milk is Aser. The Rambam learned, as we saw in the Abi Ezri, the Rambam learned that this is really a new category of Isser. It's not the same Isser as it was before. So maybe according to that, the Akum would not be Muzer on that new Isser. Fine. So now, getting back to where we started. With all this in mind, what's the story with bees' honey? It's not my question. This is the Gemara in Bechoras, Daf Zayin Amud Beis. So what's the story with honey? How do we make honey? Anybody know? I'm not sure exactly how it works scientifically, but somehow it gets from the bee to my Rosh Hashanah night table, right? So obviously honey comes from a bee. So that's the Gemara's question. How am I ever allowed to eat honey? Isn't honey a Yotzei Min HaAser? And we know anything that comes out of a Davar HaAser is not permissible to eat. Good question. So that's the Gemara's problem. So the Gemara answers, since the Pasuk says, again, we're going to use this Pasuk twice, since the Pasuk tells me that Eretz Yisrael is such a wonderful place, it's Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, it's flowing with milk and honey and it's wonderful, so you're going to tell me honey is not permissible to eat? You have a great question, I know, one second. So you're going to tell me Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, so therefore that tells me that honey is mutter. Frekt Shmuli, how can you tell me that Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash is going on Dvash Tmarim? Correct? Isn't that the obvious kasha? That dvash in that pasuk is not referring to bees' honey. Dvash in that pasuk is talking about dvash that comes out of a fruit. So what are you talking about? Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash. Nonetheless, the Gemara tells us that, yeah, you're right, the pasuk of the Kara is really going on date honey, but still we can assume that it includes this honey. Also, I don't know, it sounds a little duffel to me, but that's what the Gemara says. I'm not going to disagree with the Gemara. So that's what the heter of honey How are we allowed to eat honey? Really, al pi pashas, it should have been aser. We should have assumed that there's a problem. Yet the Gemara tells us that we have a special gzeras hakasuv to allow us to eat honey. Now, what is the story with the minhag of eating honey on Rosh Hashanah? So if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in Ramah Tavkuf Pei Gimel Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, the Ramah says the following, Yesh nogim lachol tapuach masuk midvash. Says the Ramah, some of us have a minhag that we eat a tapuach dipped in honey. Ba'omrim tischadu shalenu shana tova masuka v'chei nogim. Says the Ramah, we have a minhag that we're supposed to eat a tapuach dipped in divash, and we're supposed to give each other a bracha that we should have a shana tova umasuka. Says the Shari Tshuva, printed on the side of the page. So the Shari Tshuva quotes from the Shvas Yaakov. We should not eat the tapuach separately from the bread, because we know we're in the middle of a meal, and in the middle of a meal it's a big shaila about which bracha the person is supposed to make, whether he's supposed to make a bracha if he eats fruits. Therefore, says the Shari Tshuva, b'shem the Shvas Yaakov, a person should make hamotzi lach min haaretz. He should already have a slice of apple sliced before he starts the meal. He should take a piece of bread and a piece of honey, dip both the bread and the honey into the... dip both the apple and the bread into the honey and eat them together in order not to get himself involved in the Safik Brachas. Now, obviously we know that the halacha, the minig is not that way. The Shari Tshuva writes that our minig is that we eat them separately. We make hamotzi lach min haaretz. Some of us have the minig to dip the honey into challah as well. And then we later eat the tapuach. Says the Shari Tshuva, we should be careful to make a bracha on the tapuach, because it is not Dvar Mabon Machmas Asuda, it's more like a dessert, if that. It's more like a dessert, if even less than that, possibly. So therefore, says the Shari Tshuva, we have to be careful to make a bracha on the honey, on the apple itself. But he says on the honey, since it's tuffel to the apple, so we don't make a bracha. Very important Ha'ara Halacha L'maisa is the following. Many of us live in homes where we have a lot of simanim on Rosh Hashanah night. So some people have dates, and some people have figs, and some people have this and that, but everyone has an apple, right? So the halacha l'maisa that we have to be concerned about here is, we know in Hilchas Kadima and Brachos, many of us might be learning the sixth parak in Brachos, Ketzem Nebarchim. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a gemara about Kadima and Brachos. So we know that Shivas Aminim always takes precedence to other fruits. So it's something to bear in mind that when we're making a Bori Pir Ha'etz on the night of Rosh Hashanah, which the Shari Tshuva writes that we have to be careful to make, because it's not a part of the meal when we're having fruits as simanim. So we make a Bori Pir Ha'etz, but if we have dates or figs or something else, grapes on the table, we are not allowed to make the bracha on the apple and overlook the grapes or the figs or the dates, because those are from the Shivas Aminim. So if we have any of the Shivas Aminim on our table on Rosh Hashanah night, we have to make sure to make the Bori Pir Ha'etz on them. And even though we have an apple on the table and everyone knows there's no such thing as a Rosh Hashanah without an apple dipped in honey, we have to make sure that the apple and honey should be eaten after we eat the other simanim first. Yeah?
We make a bracha on the honey if you made a separate bracha on one of the shivas, you know?
So the Shari Tshuva writes not to, because he says the honey is obviously tuffel to the fruit that you're going to eat it with. That's what the Shari Tshuva writes. But he said that there were those who felt that honey is considered such a staple of the meal on Rosh Hashanah that maybe we should make a bracha on it on its own, but the psak is not like that. So when it comes to dipping the challah in the honey, that's going to be a little bit more complicated of a discussion. Why? Because we have to back up a little bit and look at the Raman or Achayim Kuf Samach Zayin in Hilchos Suda. So the Ramah over there talks about having salt on the table whenever we eat bread. So says the Ramah as follows: Mitzvah laniach melach al shulchan kodesh shiyivtza. We have a mitzvah to put salt on the table before we cut the challah. Ki al shulchan damal mizbeach v'ha'achila kekarbon. Says the Ramah, since our shulchan is like a mizbeach, therefore, we are supposed to put salt on the table, and we should consider it as if we're eating a karbon. Now, where do we find such a concept that our shulchan is like a mizbeach? So the Sharatzion there quotes b'shem na'achronim that a person should be careful never to kill a fly or an insect on the table, because the same way we're not allowed to have anything dead on the mizbeach, so too we're not allowed to have anything dead on our table. So a person should be careful, since a shulchan is domel mizbeach, a person should be careful never to kill an insect on the table. Sometimes we feel that it's very annoying to have them on the table, and we just kill them right there. So the Shari Tshuva writes that we should be careful not to. The Aruch HaShulchan also writes, a person should never do any dabar mos by the table, anything disgusting or disgraceful, because that is considered like a mizbeach, and we have to be careful not to disgrace the mizbeach. The Kaf HaChaim writes that we should be careful that the women should bring bedavka, the women should be the ones to bring the salt to the table before we eat, because it's to be a kapara on Eshes Lot, who didn't bring salt to the table when she was serving the guests. So that's what the Kaf HaChaim writes. It's a separate chumrah that a person should have the woman of the house bring the salt to the table and not the men. What? Oh, so that's what we're getting to. So Tosis writes in Brachos Daf Mem, exactly. Says Tosis that Anu, Bizman Azeh, that we have such good tasting bread, that we have Pas Nikia, as he calls it, we have Pas Shalanu, which is so good on its own, and we don't really need the salt. Therefore, he says that we do not have to bring salt to the table, Bizman Azeh. That's Tosis in Brachos Daf Mem. Then Tosis continues, and he writes, B'Shem Rabbeinu Menachem, that even Bizman Azeh, when we have bread that tastes so good, we should not forget about the salt at the table. We should still bring it and still put it on the bread. Why? Because, like you mentioned, the Medrash writes the following, Yisrael Yoshim Al HaShulchan, when Klal Yisrael is sitting around and we just washed our hands and now we can't talk and learning and we can't do any mitzvahs, and Mamtin and Zalzeh, we're waiting, there's a whole table full of people who are waiting to wash their hands and now we already washed and we're not allowed to talk and we're not allowed to do anything. So therefore, says the Medrash that Hasata Mekatrik, this is a perfect time for the Satan to start making trouble, to start watching over Klal Yisrael and seeing how no one's doing any mitzvahs at this particular moment. So therefore he says, HaMelech Megin Aleh. We should put salt on the table to remind the Ribbono Shalom of the schusim we have from Hakravas HaKarbanos. And that's why Rabbeinu Menachem feels that even Bizman Azeh, when we have delicious tasting bread, and we don't really need the salt to give taste to our bread, still he says we should put salt on the table. What?
Is it because the Melech waited so many thousands of years from this man of Bria Salem to bring water from Nisach HaMayim?
I don't know. That's not what Tosfos says. Could be someone else says like it.
Salt is a function of taste. That's why.
Oh, so 1 second. So that's a very good point you're making, which are the two nafkaminas that come out from this Tosfos. Exactly. That's exactly what we're getting to. So nafkamina number one is, now that we have bread that tastes delicious, that has a recipe that is edible, we don't need to put salt on it. So Tosfos feels the whole issue of having salt on the table is just to make the bread taste good. So therefore, Tosfos feels, Bizman Azeh, that we don't need the salt to make the bread taste a little better, so forget about the salt. Rabbeinu Menachem disagrees, and he says, Bizman Azeh, that even though the bread tastes good, still we should put salt on the table, exactly what you said. Another nafkamina that would come out is the following. If, let's say, a person does not have salt in his home, is he allowed to put sugar on the table to suffice for this requirement? So according to Tosfos, that the whole issue of the salt is just to make the bread taste a little better, no. So dip the bread into sugar, it'll be even better than salt. However, according to Rabbeinu Menachem, that there's something special about salt over anything else, so it wouldn't help to put sugar on the table. Says the Magen Avraham, we paskim Bizman Azeh that the halacha l'maaseh is like Rabbeinu Menachem, and a person should try as much as he can to put salt on the table before he eats bread. And even though our bread tastes delicious, still he says we should try to have salt on the table. Then the Magen Avraham continues, and he says, b'shem l'mekubalim, it's not good enough just to have salt on the table. You should even dip the bread into the salt as well. And that is some sort of halakha inyan that the Mekubalim talk about. I have no idea what the idea is behind that because I am not at all involved in these type of things. So the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Pesach, just a hakdama a little bit to Rosh Hashanah, so the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Pesach writes the following, Tafayin Hei Sif Aleph, Zakta Mechaber, Yivarech HaMotzi V'Alachilas Matzah, Seder night a person should make HaMotzi, then he should make Alachilas Matzah, V'Yitabel HaMatzah B'Melach, and he should put his matzah in salt the same way we put the bread in the salt the whole rest of the year. Says the Ramah, no. The night of the Seder, there's no reason to dip your matzahs into the salt. And he doesn't really explain why not. In the Archos Rabbeinu, which is the biography of the Stipler, so he writes that the minhag of the Stipler was that they do not put salt on the table at all, like this Ramah. They don't put salt on the table on the night of Rosh Hashanah. I'm sorry, on the night of Pesach, Leil HaSeder. So the Mishnah Berurah writes, what's the reason for this? Why should we not use salt on Leil HaSeder? So he says, because lechem oni, matzah is supposed to be a poor man's bread, and salt makes it already a very fancy meal. So therefore you should not put salt on the table. Many Acharonim find this Mishnah Berurah very troubling, because number one, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, you should live like a poor man, pas b'melech tochal. The way to be poor is to eat bread and salt. That's the main idea when an oni is eating, the only thing he uses by his meal is bread and salt. So that's number one. That should constitute lechem oni. Another ha'ara that the Achronim make is, the Gemara says in Brachos Daf Beis, when it's trying to figure out me'emesai zman kriya shma, so the Gemara says, misha ani nichnas lechol pita v'melach. The way an ani eats is that he dips his bread into salt. So this reason of the Mishnah Berurah that lechem oni ksiv, and that's why you're not supposed to put salt on it, is a little bit troubling. Therefore, says the Aruch HaShulchan and the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, a different reason. Why does the Rav say we should not use salt on the Leil HaSeder? Because we should show that chivav ha-mitzvah, that we love the matzah so much. The matzahs are so perfect, and we're so excited about the mitzvah matzah, we don't need to add anything to that mitzvah. We can just keep it the way it is, and everything's going to be wonderful, everything's going to taste great. We don't need to add salt at all to these wonderful matzahs that we have bought. So that's with regard to Leil HaSeder. Now what's with regard to the second time of the year when we find that we some communities have the minhag not to use salt? Yeah?
You can also say simply that it's Leil Shimurim. So say the reason for salt is to protect you, so you don't need protection.
Could be. Interesting point. I didn't see that though, but it's a possibility. So here's the second time of the year when we have a minhag not to use salt. That would be on Rosh Hashanah night. Many of us use honey and not salt. So let's look at this. The Mishnah Berurah says, "B'shem la'achronim, nogim b'nei Ashkenaz v'Rosh Hashanah lahatvil prusa b'dvash." We have a minig in Ashkenazi communities that we dip the challah into honey on Rosh Hashanah. Zok the Kapachayim, person should not just dip into honey. The Kapachayim writes, a person should be careful to also use salt. The same way we use salt the rest of the nights of the year, so too we should use salt on the night of Rosh Hashanah. However, if you look in the Arachas Rabbeinu, which is the biography of the Stipler, so he quotes over there, B'shem the Stipler on the Chazon Ish, that many Gedolim had the practice not to use salt at all. They only used honey on Rosh Hashanah night. And they write over there also that this practice continued not only on Rosh Hashanah night, they continued it straight through Shmini Atzeres. Until the Yom Naram were over, until Sukkot was over, they used to not use salt at all. They would only use honey. So the question is, exactly what was bothering these Gedolei Zmanenu? What's so troubling if a person also uses salt? What's the big deal? What's so bad about using both honey and salt? And why would it bother anybody? Would it bother you if you put salt first and then you use honey as a hefsek? I don't think so. That's something that's a part of the meal, something that we would do the rest of the year. So why is it that it bothers us so much if we use salt on Rosh Hashanah as opposed to using honey alone? So the idea is possibly the following. If we think about the difference, here's a little bit in Yane Machshava, and with this we will close. There is a marked difference between the properties of salt and the properties of honey. And with that we mean the following. Salt is the type of natural substance that if we ever have something that we want to preserve, if we want to keep something for a long time, we want it to have a long shelf life, so we put salt in it. Right? That's salt is a natural preservative. That everybody knows. So salt has that ability to keep something fresh for as long as possible. That's the greatest way to preserve something is to use salt. If something is already spoiled, let's say you have a spoiled piece of meat and you put salt on it, you douse it in salt, it's not going to help. Right? If something's already spoiled, obviously the salt can't turn it around and make it back to a naturally good-tasting item. But salt is something that we think about when it keeps something to its original state that it was. Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch, in fact, writes in Sefer Vayikra, the beginning of Vayikra, when it's talking about all the karbanos, we have a mitzvah over there to put salt on all the karbanos. So Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch writes, it's a little strange, where does this Indian of salt come from? Why should you put it on the karbanos? Why don't you put sugar? You want to make the karbanos taste better. Why don't you put it in a stew? Do something else. Why do you put salt on all the karbanos? Says Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch, the idea is possibly that salt is ihishtanus. Salt is showing that nothing changes. We preserve it. We were given a mitzvah of akravas karbanos. We're showing the Rabbanu Shalom. We did everything exactly the way we were supposed to do it. We did not change one iota. We did everything exactly in the perfect way that you asked us to do it. And we didn't change. We didn't move right or left. We didn't do anything different. And therefore, he says, we have a special mitzvah over here to put salt on the karbanos to make that point, to emphasize it, and to show that every time we're makriv karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, every time we do avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, we're doing everything because the Rabbanu Shalom told us to do it, and we're doing it exactly how he told us to do it as well. That's with regard to salt. However, when it comes to honey, we find something very, very different. The Gemara tells us in the end of Avodah Zarah that one is permitted to buy honey from a non-Jew. Ask the Rishonim, why am I permitted to buy honey from a non-Jew? Shouldn't it concern anybody? Maybe the non-Jew threw a piece of nevela into it. Maybe he threw some non-kosher items into the honey. Same way we have an issue of Chalav Yisrael, right? A person is not allowed to eat Chalav Akum. Nowadays, whatever, of Moshe's Tshuva, but the Ikar Adin is that I'm not really allowed to eat Chalav Akum. So why is it that I'm allowed to eat Dvash from a non-Jew? Why am I allowed to buy honey from a non-Jew? Similarly, the Rush in Brachas quotes the Rabbeinu Yonah that why is it that it's mutter to eat honey? Don't we know that sometimes the legs of the bees get stuck in the honey? So Dvash Dvorim is where we get all our honey from. We eat it from the bees. Yet sometimes, and very often the Rishonim say, parts of the animal of the bee get stuck into the honey. So how am I allowed to eat it? Don't we know a bee is a non-kosher animal? Very similar question to that which the Rishonim are dealing with in Avodah Zarah. Why are we not, number one, why are we not worried that the non-Jew threw something non-kosher into it? And number two, why aren't we concerned over the fact that the bee itself, parts of the bee get stuck into the honey because it's so sticky and it's not easy to get that out? So why is it that we're allowed to eat honey and we're not concerned with these two problems? So Tosis writes, and this is quoted in Yerodeah, Tosis writes that no, we have an issue of the legs in the honey of the bees. Now that's not a problem because the legs that get stuck in the honey are like bones, and bones don't give off any flavor. No satam of gum. It's not going to add any flavor into the honey, so therefore we're allowed to eat the honey. Okay, it's one suggestion. But the Rush writes B'Shem Rabbeinu Yonah something entirely different. Says the Rush B'Shem Rabbeinu Yonah that the kochel shel advash is so strong and so potent that anything that falls into the dvash will be totally taken over by the honey itself. Even though the bee sometimes has its legs get stuck into the honey, even though sometimes you have a non-Jew might throw a nevela into the honey, sometimes you're going to have things like that, where a piece of meat, non-kosher meat, is thrown into the honey and it gets mixed up into the vat and then it gets crushed up and we don't even know where it is, still we're allowed to buy the honey from the non-Jew. Why? Because honey is so strong, the characteristic of honey is that it takes over something and it makes it into the honey itself. So that's where the Rishonim write, and that's why it's permissible for us to eat the honey, albeit that it has sometimes pieces of nevela in it, sometimes the non-Jew threw something non-kosher into it, sometimes the legs of the bee may have gotten stuck in it, still we would be permitted to eat such a thing. So now come to Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, we try to work on ourselves, we try to do a tshuva shlema, we try to become different people. So what do we want to use Rosh Hashanah night? We want to use the preservative, we want to use the salt and show that we're the same person, we want to be fresh and show the Ribbono Shel Olam that we're the same guy, just keep us the way we are? No. Possibly the idea is that we want to take the dvash, we want to take something which is totally overpowering, it's something that can take even the most spoiled item, even a spoiled piece of meat, even the legs of the bee, and it can take it over and turn it into a whole new entity, it can make it into a whole new characteristic, it can have new properties, and it can become honey itself. So therefore that's the idea why on Rosh Hashanah night, and some have the minhag that they do it through Shemini Atzeres, when we're trying to show that we're better people, we're trying to show that we have changed, we're not the same old people who do Averis, that's possibly the reason why we're makbid to use dvash and not salt. The Chafetz Chaim writes in his Akdama to Likutei Halachos on Kachim. He says that when it comes to Limanat Torah, so the Pasuk tells us, Mesukim midvash v'nofas tzufim, that learning Torah is sweeter than honey. Says the Chafetz Chaim, that's based on these Rishonim, that the Rishonim write, that the reason we're allowed to eat honey is because the honey totally overtakes the Ragli Advorim and the Nevela, it takes it over and it makes it as if it's not there, it makes it into a whole new property, a whole new entity. Therefore, says the Chafetz Chaim, it's the same thing. A person who throws himself into learning, a person who throws himself into the Torah and really involves himself in the proper way can be totally transformed into a whole new type of personality. He can be transformed into a new person and he can be made into something special. But Yashiv writes in his Ars to Becharis Daf Zayin, in the black swarm that they have from him, so Rabbi Yashiv writes the following, that even though the Acharonim write that it's mutter to eat the honey because it will take over the properties of something that falls into it, the Acharonim do write, some Acharonim write this on Yerodeah, that that's only if pieces of a bee fell in. But let's say you have a whole barrier. Let's say you have a whole entity that falls into the honey. Let's say you have an entire insect that falls in. So some Acharonim say then the honey would not be permissible. Why? Because honey only has enough power to take over little parts that fall in, particles that fall in, but it doesn't have enough power to take over a whole entire entity that might fall in. Says Rabbi Yashiv, that's what it means, Mesukim midvash v'nofas tzufim. Liman HaTorah is not the same as honey, it's greater than honey. Liman HaTorah can not only take little impurities that we have and fix them up, it can take the worst type of person. It can take a person who's totally a Beria Chadasha, he's a horrible person, he's something totally different than the Torah, but the Torah can take him over and transform him into become something totally different and a better person. Mesukim midvash, it can make him even better. Honey only has the power to transform little bits and pieces of things, but the Torah has the power to transform us entirely. And finally, we find a Medrash. The Medrash writes in Bamidbar Rabbah the following. Kol tamid chacham sheim bodeya, nevela tova imenu. Very strange line. What does that mean? The tamid chacham not have deya, tamid chacham doesn't have common sense, who doesn't use the Torah in the proper way. Nevela tova imenu. So the simple understanding of that is, if you're a tamid chacham and you worked hard in your life to learn a lot, but you're going nowhere with that knowledge, and you're just using it for all the wrong reasons, so nevela tova imenu. A piece of meat is even better than you. You're a nothing, you're a nobody, you're not even a human being. However, the Chabina Rav explained, based on all that we've said, the Chabina Rav explained as follows. The Rishonim were bothered, why is it that we're allowed to eat honey? Aren't we concerned that the non-Jew threw a piece of nevela into the honey? Aren't we concerned that maybe there's a piece of non-kosher meat in the honey and that's what we're going to be eating? So say the Rishonim that no, honey has the power to totally transform that piece of nevela, make it into something new. Says the Medrash, Kol tamid chacham she'en bo deya, If a Talmud Chacham can sit and he can learn and he can study and he can involve himself and be totally engrossed in Limud HaTorah, but Ein Bo Deya, after all that, he still doesn't know how to conduct himself properly, he still doesn't know how to act, he still doesn't know how he's supposed to be using his mind, how he's supposed to be using all that he learned. Even the piece of nevela that falls into some honey and is able to be transformed, even that is greater than you. The power of the honey that it could do to the nevela is greater than you, bum, you lowlife, who tried to learn so much, you're a Talmud Chacham, but you became a nothing, you became a nobody. Even the nevela is tova yemen. So this is just a little bit of the background into the minig. Many of us might have thought that eating honey on Rosh Hashanah is a simple minig. It seems not to be so simple. There's a lot that goes into all of that. I'm glad that it's 8 o'clock. But we'll finish in 1 second. And it's something really to think about. You know, I very much enjoy preparing shiurim on minhagim sometimes, because we think that minhagim are strange, and we think that minhagim sometimes really don't have a background. And when you really look into things, sometimes we find that there are so many elements that go into our simple minhagim, to what we consider simple minhagim, and sometimes very interesting and halachic ideas that are behind them. So it's something to pay attention to and something to look into on our own sometimes when we involve ourselves in different types of minhagim throughout the year, maybe to put a little bit of thought into them and figure out exactly what they are all about. Ksiva v'chasimato.